Hey everybody, I'm Julia Furlan, and this is the news from BuzzFeed News. It has been a week, and there is a lot to go over. So, we've got a look at what Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement means, a breakdown of what's been happening overall in the Supreme Court this week, a look at how gentrification affects noise complaints, and an explanation of Mexico's big deal presidential election. Okay, let's do this.
Justice Anthony Kennedy said today he is retiring after 3 decades on the high court. Kennedy, who is now 81, held the swing vote in...
It's going to be the biggest election in Mexican history, with positions up for grabs from Mexico City mayor to congressional seats to the top job itself.
Abortion rights opponents are celebrating a victory in the U.S. Supreme Court today.
Justice Anthony Kennedy announced his decision to step down as of July 31st on Wednesday of this week and shook everything up. This comes after a week of really substantial decisions on the Supreme Court, but you'll hear about those a little bit later in the show. The implications of this retirement could extend for years or even decades. On the lead this week, Shani Hilton sits down with Chris Geidner, who covers the Supreme Court in D.C., and Nabiha Syed, BuzzFeed's general counsel, to sort through what's going on and what Kennedy's retirement could mean for the Supreme Court.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Nabiha.
Hello.
Hey.
So the big news this week, the really, truly seismic in a way that we always say the news is, but this actually is news, was that Justice Kennedy resigned.
Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy sent shockwaves across the country today, I think it's fair to say.
I knew today would be a rough day because I knew that everyone would be upset because I was watching CNN, everyone was going crazy.
We're getting word that Anthony Kennedy, the Supreme Court Justice, has decided to retire.
Many people are reeling from the announcement, of course, that Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy is retiring.
Chris, who is he?
Justice Anthony Kennedy. He was appointed to the court by President Reagan. He's been a federal judge for 43 years. He's been on the court for 30 years. So he basically, over the course of his time on the court, became sort of he hates the term, but the swing vote on the court. He became the key vote.
Right. And that was, you know, what people were saying immediately was like, this is a swing vote. But over the course of a couple of days, it really seems like people have taken a little bit more time to dig into his legacy. And I don't think he's as clear of a swing vote as people think he is.
Well, I mean, the problem is he's a swing vote on things on which there was actually a swing.
Right.
there are a lot of things that the court has been fundamentally conservative for the past 20, 30 years. And on those issues, on corporate issues in particular, there hasn't been a swing. But in popular culture, he became, perhaps because of the fact that on some of the hot button issues that really mattered to liberals over the past 2, 3, 4 decades, abortion and same-sex marriage, he provided one of the critical votes to reaffirm Roe and then to sort of pave the way for and then hold that marriage equality was considered.
Right.
I would say, though, that whatever swing vote role he may have played in the past, he certainly didn't do that this term, where he didn't side with liberals on one significant 5-4 case. I mean, he basically was a shrug emoji in a black gown for some of these deeply consequential decisions. And I am still stinging from the Muslim ban case earlier this week from talking about crisis pregnancy centers and what they actually have to disclose under the First Amendment. There are some really big issues where he was a vote that could have mattered in ways that maybe would have made sense given his judicial philosophy, particularly when it comes to gerrymandering and voting rights. And he didn't take that opportunity. And so, you know, looking at his full legacy and looking at this last term is kind of an interesting contrast.
I mean, but at the same time, let's remember that swing vote doesn't mean he always votes with the liberals.
Totally fair. Totally fair.
But the decisions that were made in the last week have all been fairly conservative rulings.
It's true that he didn't join the liberals this term to make any 5-4 decisions. I mean, I don't think Nabiha is wrong that certainly we look at what he did this term on some big issues that he's expressed a lot of interest in the past, he basically was okay with leaving the court with those issues unresolved.
You're right. A swing vote, you can swing either way. But I think so much of the hand-wringing yesterday, and I am a hand-wringer, I am terrified of what's to come, I think almost valorized Justice Kennedy and what he had meant to the liberal cause in a way that overstated his contributions. It was a little bit more unpredictable.
We're 100% in agreement on that.
So to bring us to the present, what I think is fascinating and the reason why people like Unabiha are so freaked out and other people on Trump's side are so excited is because the person that comes in next is clearly going to be about as far right, I think, as you could expect. That's what I would expect. Or do you disagree? I mean, I know that Trump is operating from a list.
I mean, we've got this list, and there is a wide range within that list, from some names that appear to be more libertarian bent to some who appear to be more social conservative bent. But they're all likely to be at or to the right of Kennedy, and there's a significant chance that they will be significantly to the right unless we find them to end up having sort of some similar views as he had, particularly on what the word liberty means in the Constitution.
One tweet that I saw going around was somebody predicting that abortion will be dead within 18 months. And I know that it's a little bit more complicated than that, as in if Roe is overturned, that basically gives the states the opportunity to regulate abortion more closely with how they wish, as opposed to like it just overturns abortion throughout the country. But I know that that's something that a lot of people are incredibly concerned about.
I think we're also seeing a lot of the framing of this fight, to the extent that there can plausibly be a fight when Republicans are in the majority, in terms of abortion, because I think that raises the stakes. Often fights over the Supreme Court, I think, to many people can seem sort of wonky or elite or like, oh, it decides sort of these like random questions. And I think we're really in this moment where not only is everyone asking themselves questions about democratic institutions writ large, we're coming off a week where really big things were decided. We're coming off a term where huge things were decided. And we're looking at our country when things are so divided to see, okay, who's going to come in and potentially make these very firm decisions that sets the tone for decades to come. And I think abortion is a huge part of that. It's a big part of that framing. And you can definitely see Democrats already speaking about that, Republicans already sort of cheering about what's going to be possible. So it will be fraught. And I think you're right to identify that topic as the lightning rod.
So this week has been wild. As we talked about, these decisions were some of the ones that you named. I think that they were all pretty ground shaking for various parts of the country and various groups of people. How unusual was this? Is it a term? Is that what we call it?
Yeah. It was a momentous term in terms of the cases. And a lot of this, I think, did have to do with what Kennedy was willing to really put his foot down on, that he left a lot of questions unresolved. And so some of the things that could have been really groundbreaking decisions sort of became lesser decisions on partisan gerrymandering, on obviously the way that the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision was determined, on the fact that the court really shied away from taking any systemic look at the death penalty, which Justice Breyer and Ginsburg have been asking the court to do. And there was some hope from people who want to see the death penalty eliminated that Kennedy would do that. And so, I mean, in that sense, you sort of had this potentially huge term on some of those issues where Kennedy was a swing vote on the left, sort of take a backseat to the cases where he was a shrug emoji in a robe, to use Nabiha's phrase, on cases in which he sided with the right. And they were able to then issue decisions that, particularly when a new justice who's as or more conservative than him comes on, can sort of be expanded to have a great impact on people's lives.
I think the other thing that is the undercurrent of a lot of the freak out is that people feel as though the Republicans stole, in quotes, a seat from Barack Obama after Scalia died. And Obama wanted to put forward Merrick Garland, and Mitch McConnell stepped in and prevented that from happening.
It is a president's constitutional right to nominate a Supreme Court justice, and it is the Senate's constitutional right to act as a check on a president and withhold its consent.
The language being that the American people should decide, as in we should wait until after the election of the next president. And now that's coming up again. But talk to me like I'm stupid. The president will not change in November. So I don't quite understand the logic of let's wait until after the election to pick this person.
I mean, well, and this is actually where extending analogies causes problems, because where this came out of is that back when President Obama nominated Merrick Garland, Republicans invoked what they called the Biden rule, and it related to a speech that Biden had given when he was in the Senate.
If a Supreme Court justice resigns tomorrow or within the next several weeks, President Bush should consider following the practice of a majority of his predecessors and not name a nominee until after the November election is completed.
But when Antonin Scalia died, we were talking about the winter. We were talking about February. We were talking about the fact that there was a full year left in Obama's presidency when this nomination was made. And the Republicans still sort of stretched that rule of the last 6 months into the last year of a presidency. And now what the Democrats are doing is, well, you stretched a six-month rule into a one-year rule. So we're going to say that any election year should have this same rule.
I think there's some undertone of this, too, of generally how we treat each other. We're not really operating with this what's good for the goose should be good for the gander. We're not really behaving with my least favorite word, especially in this last week, civil way. That this institution that theoretically should remain above the fray of politics has been politicized, and we're going to see yet another knockdown, drag out round of politicizing. And I think even just seeing what people have been tweeting and saying in the last day shows that, like, it's just beginning. And so I think there's some of that, too, at play here, where everyone is trying to just get in there and try to get it to go their way in this kind of naked pursuit of power, which is what our politics has really become, and maybe always was, but now we can see it. And to me, the deepest irony of all of this is, if Justice Kennedy stood for anything, it was for this idea of the rule of law, of attempting to be civil, of trying to hear out these different sides. And he chose the sides that made the most sense to him, certainly, and often explained them beautifully. And his departure almost feels like it's a departure of that mode of engaging with one another, too, which is its own sort of bittersweet moment.
I think it is definitely a question that at some point he's going to be asked on the record to talk about. But I think there is this fundamental question that's still unanswered about the legacy that he's put in writing, contrasted with the time in which he chose to retire.
That's exactly right.
I mean, it doesn't appear to be a retirement born of necessity. It was a retirement of choice. And I think that explaining why he thinks that those are coherent and do not conflict with one another is something that he's going to be held to talk about as he continues in, I mean, he presumably is going to continue a public life, if not as an active Supreme Court justice.
Chris, Nabia, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Shawnee Hilton, Chris Geidner, and Nabiha Syed doing much better explaining than I ever could about the Supreme Court. JoJo, my friend, how are you? So listeners, if you haven't met JoJo yet, let me introduce you. Whenever you hear that little sound, it means that JoJo, our trusty news bot, will be able to give you more information on the story that we're talking about. To communicate with JoJo, open your messaging app on your cell phone, Then type in JoJo's number. It's 929-236-9577. Finally, text JoJo the word that we give you. They will send you a text with some more info on what we're discussing so that you can read up on it after you're done with this episode. If you want to read more of Chris Geidner's outstanding coverage of Justice Kennedy's retirement, text JoJo the word SCOTUS right now. That's S-C-O-T-U-S. And you'll get it right on your phone. Again, JoJo's number is 929-236-9577. And it's also in the show notes for this show. There's been a lot going down on Supreme Court this week, aside from Justice Kennedy's retirement. So to make sure that you're all caught up on everything, we brought in politics reporter Dominic Holden to play a fun new game that we made up on the spot. This is
So What Did I Miss?
Dom, we're going to play a round of a brand new game, the hottest game show in the land.
Yeah.
It's called 30 Second Supreme Court.
Right. / Was I Paying Attention to Twitter?
Exactly. So every June, the Supreme Court sits to announce orders and opinions on cases that they've been hearing all term. Dom, we're going to play you some tape related to some of the huge Supreme Court decisions that were announced this week, and your job is to identify them and explain them to us. Are you ready?
I am so ready.
You look ready. Okay, number one.
The court has consistently held that government hostility towards people of faith is unconstitutional and has no place in a diverse society. And the state of California demeaned religious organizations with pro-life views by ordering them to speak messages and to turn women towards abortion.
Okay, Dom, what is this lady talking about?
Well, that lady is Kristen Wagner from Alliance Defending Freedom, and she also argued that big Christian gay Baker case, where the Baker won recently on pretty narrow grounds. But that's her. They also are concerned about abortion. And yeah. In this case, there's an organization called the National Institute of Family and Life Advocates, and they have these crisis pregnancy centers. And these pregnancy centers tend to present themselves as being medical facilities, but you come in and they don't offer abortion. In fact, they steer women toward not getting an abortion, keeping the baby, providing some sort of services in that direction. The California legislature was not into this idea that women could be pulled in unaware that they could get low-cost or free abortion. So they passed a law and they said, you've got to post information in these things saying that a contraceptive and abortion services are available, that this is not a medical center if it's not a medical center. And these groups sued because they said that was compelled speech. Like the same way the First Amendment protects your right to speak freely, it also says you can't be forced to present a message that you disagree with. So that's what Kristen Wagner was at there. What the long-term consequence of this could be is it could send a message to other state legislatures, hey, you can't try to crack down on these crisis pregnancy centers, and so there may be room for more of them to proliferate and bring women in without letting them know that abortion is an option.
Okay. That Kristen lady seems busy.
She is a very, very smart lawyer.
The next thing that we're going to talk about has been all over everyone's news feeds. So this is from a protest in New York City that happened this week.
So this is a protest where they are shaming Trump's travel ban, which he had originally telegraphed as being a ban on Muslims entering the country. This is another one of those 5-4 decisions at the Supreme Court along ideological lines. Mm-hmm. And because the actual text of the order, the third travel ban, didn't refer to Muslims, then it was acceptable and it was not unconstitutional. So boom, Trump's third attempt at a travel ban goes into effect and is upheld by the Supreme Court.
Oh, my God. Wow. Okay, Dom, here's the next one.
The Texas decision comes in a case that has lasted so long and is so complicated that even election experts find it daunting to discuss.
This was just such a mess.
It was a mess. There is no question it was a mess.
That's NYU law professor Richard Pildes, followed by Loyola professor Justin Levitt.
Dom, My question for you is, what is a mess?
So the mess, as referred to by those lawyers and so excellently described by Nina Totenberg at NPR. Shout out to Nina Totenberg. There is this huge gerrymandering dispute. It's all over the country, but this case arose out of Texas over these state house maps and congressional maps that were allegedly drawn with a racial intent, specifically to suppress the vote of Latino and African American voters. And this case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court largely argued in favor of the Texas lawmakers who had drawn the maps this way.
Mm.
What this means, 5 years after the Supreme Court gutted part of the Voting Rights Act, is that states could see an opportunity to draw lines as they see fit, not worry that the Supreme Court is going to find a violation, not worry that the federal government is going to impose some sort of oversight, and discourage people who live in these gerrymandered districts from bringing complaints because they're worried now that they're not going to win. And we will see more gerrymandered districts, which often will either disperse voters of color or collect voters of color, so that even if they are a majority of a population or have a good stronghold, they're not fully represented in the statewide vote results.
Tom, you did a great job. Thank you very much.
I'm glad I passed this test.
You passed this extremely difficult test.
I'm never going to give up Twitter. It tells me everything.
So, what, if you took a step back, what are the larger things that you see at work in these cases and also all of the other ones that you have been covering and following?
I think the big takeaway here is that Mitch McConnell in the Senate denied a hearing of Merrick Garland to be a Supreme Court justice who'd been nominated by former President Obama. And instead, they kept the seat vacant. And instead, they got Neil Gorsuch, a hardline conservative who has consistently formed the fifth vote in these 5-4 decisions. So Republicans have really prevailed by using a political sleight of hand in the Senate to influence the Supreme Court bench. They're getting the policies that they want, even if Congress ends up doing very, very little in the meantime.
Okay. Dom, thank you so much for playing the game show that's really sweeping the nation. All the youths are playing it. 30-second Supreme Court.
Yep, we're going to be robing deep.
Robing deep. Let's hear it for politics reporter Dominic Holden. If you want to hear more from Dominic Holden, Chris, and all kinds of people from the BuzzFeed newsroom, text JoJo the word WHOMST. That's WHOMST. And once you do, JoJo will send you a list of everybody who appeared on this week's episode. WHOMST. If you walk around in the summer in basically any residential neighborhood in New York City, you're going to see a lot of folks hanging out outside. They're on their stoops. They're playing dominoes. It's like kind of part of the thing. Another huge part of life in New York City is gentrification. And looking at the cross-section between those two things, we have Data with a Heartbeat with data reporter Lam Tuivo. Oh, this is so familiar to me. It hits me right in my heart.
So this kind of ambience has been part of the block for decades. But more recently, this kind of noise may have also contributed to the submissions of thousands of 311 complaints on that block.
And 311, of course, is the city thing that you call for, like, non-emergency issues that you would have living in New York and other cities, too.
Quality of life.
Quality of life
is what they call them.
Okay, cool.
And so we looked at a specific subset of those complaints. Neighbors complaining about neighbors. And we found that starting 2015 all the way through 2017, this short block was affiliated with close to 3,000 complaints.
That's like 10 calls a day.
Almost,
like almost
yeah.
10 calls a day?
Yeah. That's also like with online complaints and calls, people just kind of like going ham on this subject, right?
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, what also happened is that police came often. And we talked to about a dozen residents who are Dominican, who have lived on that block for their entire lives. And they said that after gathering outside for decades, kind of undisturbed, doing their thing, they suddenly had to stop.
And they've been playing dominoes in that, like, classic New York way for years and years and years.
Yeah.
Right?
We talked to this really nice man. He was 105 years old.
Whoa.
Who had been sitting out in the streets like that every summer for decades, 40 years, he said.
Que no me siento bien, que hay desorden.
He said that he doesn't feel good. He said, I don't feel good.
Some people that we talked to said that they felt harassed. And what also happened on that block was that it had heavily gentrified and more white people had moved in.
That sounds familiar to me. I feel like I've heard this story before.
She called the police on an 8-year-old little girl.
There's laws about this park. And
I know the laws about this park.
And charcoal grills are not allowed here.
The whole world gonna see you, boo.
Yeah, and illegally selling water without a permit.
Where did they get called for? Because there are two black guys sitting here meeting me?
Yes.
It seems like variations on a theme.
Right, right. And I think while all of these other incidences went viral, we wanted to see how that looked across one major city. We looked at millions of 311 complaints, filtered them down to find out basically how many complaints are out there in New York where people are complaining about noise, about their neighbors, about each other. So to see whether there was a correlation of 311 calls and gentrification, we looked at median home values, median incomes, and education levels.
Some of the signifiers of gentrification.
Exactly. All the economic factors.
Okay.
And then separately, we also looked at race. So what we found was that in gentrified areas and gentrified census tracts, there were more complaints per capita, right?
Interesting. Unsurprising.
Yes. As a place changes, as more white people move into a space, as the home values go up, there are more 311 calls.
And that means more interactions with police in the neighborhood too, right?
Correct.
And what are the potential effects of these increased police calls?
So the police has to respond to these calls, right? Some people in the neighborhood that we looked at in Harlem were like, police officers told them, look, we know you guys don't have any crime, but we just have to show up. People keep complaining.
Uh-huh.
We can't change this. And this can play out in a bunch of different ways. Sometimes police may park their car there and then leave. Other times there may be tensions or maybe an arrest would happen.
And then there's the possible threat of police violence, which can flare up in a moment and puts everybody in this very difficult situation.
There's basically also then more data collection about those neighborhoods. Like, over-surveillance of a space makes it easier for people then to make a case later. If you have 1,000 noise complaints about one block, they can be like, this is a block that has traditionally caused a lot of trouble, right?
Yeah.
And that could then have detrimental, like, consequences when it comes to predictive policing, things like that.
So what do the gentrifiers say about all this?
Interestingly enough, we talked to a lot of people on that block, some who had moved in like a few months ago, and they were just saying things like, oh, I like this neighborhood, but I don't feel like I belong. But the vast majority of the newcomers said that they had never filed a complaint. There were two white men, however, that we spoke to on the streets, one who was in the same census tract a block over.
It's people who are trying to sleep or trying to raise children, trying to get up for work early.
And another who was actually on that same block,
uh-huh,
who had filed 311 complaints before. And they were saying things like, look, I don't really want to go downstairs and tell my neighbor to stop blaring that music.
I see.
This neighborhood used to be a bad neighborhood, is what one of them said.
So, like, these folks are saying that they'd rather call 311 than go downstairs and say, like, hey, Tony, can you turn it down?
Yes. I talked to all of these long-term neighbors. They know each other. They grew up around each other.
Right, right.
So they wouldn't not call the cops on each other. What we've shown through the data is that what factors into whether someone calls 311 or not, from talking to lawyers, from talking to experts, and from looking at the data, is, yes, a class issue. And there could be a race issue because people don't know each other. For them, a certain culture is foreign. But what also is important is that there's a lack of community when you have a neighborhood change so rapidly. Right. One of the neighborhoods we went into went from 5% to 20% white within just 16 years. That's a huge difference. That's a huge changeover, right? And so understanding that there's a breakdown of community, that then shows itself in 311 calls.
Right.
And so figuring out how to speak to one another and building longer-term, lasting relationships with your neighbors is something that may have gotten lost with gentrification.
That was Data with a Heartbeat with Lam Tuy Vo, who is always welcome on My Stoop, as are you listeners. But for you to read Lam's story, text JoJo 311, the numbers 311. So now we turn to the presidential election in Mexico, which is going down on Sunday, July 1st. Depending on when you're hearing this, the election may have even happened already, but that doesn't mean you don't need to know what's going on, because we've been hearing a lot about Mexico lately. This is What in the World with our world editor, Miriam Elder.
We are hours away from a major presidential election in Mexico, and I am joined by Carla Zabludovsky, BuzzFeed News' Mexico Bureau Chief and Latin America correspondent, who's joining us from Mexico City. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Miriam. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. I have so many questions, but let's just start with the basics. So this election is big, it's exciting, but who are the major candidates and how do their positions on the U.S. differ in particular?
So there are four main candidates, all men, and they all agree on their positions in regards to the U.S. And that is that there needs to be dialogue with the U.S., but first and foremost, there needs to be respect.
Right. Trump has not been quiet about his feelings about the Mexican government or the Mexican people. Do they, like, does his name come up a lot in rallies and in campaign commercials and things? Is he a big presence in the campaign?
Surprisingly not. Mexicans' plates are so full. There's like horrible record corruption. There are the record homicides. The economy is not doing well. And so Mexicans are so concerned with how things are going at home that there's really not a lot of bandwidth for them to think about Trump.
So, Carla, you mentioned that violence is a huge problem, and this has been one of the most violent elections in Mexican history. More than 120 candidates or politicians have been killed throughout this campaign. That is a huge number. What's happening?
Well, first of all, this is the biggest election in Mexico's history. There are 3,408 positions up for grabs. But this is also the first time that organized crime is looking to have a place within government rather than just making a deal with it, you know? So they are looking to eliminate rivals, and that's exactly what they've been doing.
So now I want to talk about the clear front runner, who's Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Did I say that somewhat correctly?
Yes, but it gets easier because we all call him AMLO.
Perfect. So let's talk about AMLO. So as I understand it, AMLO is a populist, but he's also a super leftist. And yet you hear a lot of comparisons to Donald Trump. Is that because of the rhetoric or his style? Like, who is this AMLO?
Yes, he's a populist and that makes him similar to Trump. But it's too tempting to draw strong comparison. And there really isn't that much that is similar between them. I think one of the things that makes them similar is that they're both really good at simplifying concepts and making them accessible to the general population. So, for example, corruption is a huge issue in this election. And AMLO, he's not talking about corruption in, let's say, a specific program within a specific government office, and then say, like, he's going to decrease corruption there by 5% or whatever. He just says he's going to be honest, and other people will be honest because they'll follow his example, and that's what people connect with.
And so he's run several times before and lost. What do you think is different this time? Why is he so clearly in the lead?
Because Mexicans are so fed up with the system. You know, the ruling party, it's called the PRI. They ruled for 71 years uninterruptedly, and then they were kicked out of office by the PAN. And the PAN ruled for two administrations, and then the PRI came back. So this is the first time that people in Mexico are just like hopeless in regards to what we've already seen, and a little bit hopeful because he's new. I mean, well, he was mayor of Mexico City, but he's never governed the country. So it's just like this last hope that this will be the way out of our problems.
Right. And so, sorry to come at this from an American perspective, but I'm curious. So let's say, you know, the election happens, AMLO wins. And then for all of us sitting up here in the U.S., where Mexico has become a huge issue for Trump and for his administration, be it the border wall, be it immigration, be it NAFTA, like what would an AMLO presidency mean for the United States?
Oof. Well, AMLO is very inward looking. So he's like Trump in that regard. He is, like I said, a populist, and he really represents, like, you know, workers and the people that work in agriculture. And so he's going to really take care of Mexican people within Mexico. He's not looking, you know, to make a lot of free trade agreements or to make a lot, you know, to bring neighbors closer. He's kind of just like Trump. He's catering to the population within Mexico. And so I think that the relationship, it doesn't look like it's going to get closer. And I think that the best we can hope for is just that it doesn't deteriorate any further.
Yeah, and maybe that's the type of person, honestly, that Trump can understand. Carla, thank you so much for joining us and for explaining this wild election. And we will be watching the results right along with you. So thank you.
Thank you, Miriam.
Bye.
Bye.
That was our world editor, Miriam Elder, with Mexico Bureau Chief and Latin America correspondent Carla Zabludovsky. If you want to follow the Mexico elections for yourself, just text JoJo the word Mexico. Again, their number is 929-236-9577. And that's our show for the week. Thank you so much for listening. We made it just for you. If you like what you heard, please, 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 pretty please rate and review us in Apple Podcasts and give us all the stars. It'll help more people find us and enjoy the show. And if you want to, you don't have to, but you can, tell people about this show. Tell them, I heard this new podcast. It was great. You should listen to it. It's called The News. It comes out on Saturdays. Okay, thanks. And don't forget, if you text JoJo the word whomst, you can get a list of everyone in this week's episode and their Twitter handles. This show was produced by the Pod Squad. That's Megan Dietry, Alex Laughlin, Camila Salazar, and me, Julia Furlan. Our boss is Cindy Vanegas Jesuale, and our music is by Chad Crouch. And special thank you to JoJo, who, fun fact, is rooting so hard in the World Cup that they nearly short-circuited this week. And of course, because JoJo is my friend, they're rooting for Brazil. Okay? Okay, everybody should root for Brazil. The end. Tune in next week for another episode of The News from BuzzFeed News.